You can help new Christians or those curious about the true Easter miracle with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, A Simple Explanation of Easter. These booklets are sold in packets of 20, making them perfect for outreach programs, new member classes, and in church pews. Find out more about A Simple Explanation of Easter at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month, A Simple Explanation of Easter.
The one thing we have to recognize that is true of New Testament biblical Christianity is that it embraces hope and never embraces despair.
I think thinking about the church not so much as an army engaged in war, as a community engaged in protest.
Apologetics is demonstrating that the proclamation of law and gospel itself is embedded in history.
The reason why we say that the Lord's Supper forgives sins, that baptism forgives sins, that absolution forgives sins, is because Jesus promised that those things forgive sins.
Amateur home improvers in Italy love Issues, Etc.
You never can tell. I'm getting the feeling that words like democracy, that used to just mean, well, our form of government, it's not an entirely accurate way of describing our form of government. We are a representative republic. We are an entity that is defined more by its federalism than by its voting system. But we used to say democracy, and that just meant the American way of life, the American political system. Now I'm getting the sense that it doesn't mean that anymore. It's sounding a lot less like an American form of government and a lot more like something else. The word democracy is actually being used as a cudgel against things like the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. How can that be? Greetings and welcome back to Issues, Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about the new civics in public school education. Joy Pullman will be our guest in a little bit later. Dr. John Bombaro joins us. We'll talk scientism and superstition. Joy Pullman is managing editor of The Federalist. She's author of the book, The Education Invasion, and a recent column titled, If You Liked Common Core, You're Going to Love Joe Biden's Anti-American Civics Project. Joy, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Joy, what is Educating for American Democracy National Forum?
Well, it seems to be kind of a pop-up group that is supposed to be kind of a umbrella group, I guess, I would say, for a bunch of different organizations that are attempting to basically create a common core for U.S. history and government instruction in the country. So their goal is basically to nationalize the way that those subjects are studied in schools. And they have provided basically an outline for the kind of curriculum that they think should be that national framework.
How does this group propose that we reform civics education?
Well, they have, you know, a rather lengthy document that contains what are basically called in the business standards. They basically define, you know, what kids should be learning in classes at different grades on this subject material. But the long story short is the standards have been used about 40 years since the 1990s. They started being pushed by the federal government, and since then they've become just basically the way that public education curriculum is run. But the dirty little secret about these is that they're not very effective. Basically, just having a goal and sticking it on a sheet somewhere doesn't necessarily mean that it's happening in classrooms. And that's why these sorts of programs always come with some sort of what they call accountability measures, but are basically ways of forcing bureaucrats into the classroom to force teachers into compliance with other people's opinions about what kids should be learning and when.
What do you make of the fact that these plans for civics education have bipartisan support?
Well, I mean, using the word bipartisan or transpartisan is one of the words that the folks used in their recent report that they released. Well, first of all, you know, they say that more than 300 people worked on this project so far. And, you know, a fellow from the Hudson Institute was only able to identify approximately 10 of them who are either conservative leaning or just not very partisan in their public work. So we've got 290 leftists and 10 folks who are either, you know, neutral, not very political, or could be called to be on the political right. So bipartisan kind of, under that sort of circumstance, seems a little bit more like window dressing. And the other thing is, you know, look, typically, honestly, when in these days, the real philosophical differences among Americans about very important matters, such as teaching our country's history, they are so deep that it is very hard to do anything that is truly bipartisan that isn't either watered all the way down as to be somewhat meaningless or basically the what I call the uniparty in Washington, D.C., basically imposing on the rest of the country a really terrible kind of ruling class vision of what other people should be doing with their lives. So usually when I mean, it seems great to seek bipartisanship. And I actually do think sometimes there can be decent compromises made between people with very different ideas. But most of the time in Washington, D.C., when you see that label slapped on something, it's a warning that what's about to happen is a really terrible idea, a really terrible idea that a bunch of bureaucrats support, no matter what the affiliation is next to their names.
What is Action Civics?
Action Civics is really kind of what's the goal behind this whole project to Common Core U.S. History and Government. And the short answer is it basically is using children for political activism. And so we know this is the case because there has been, you know, about a decade worth of work in leftist organizations, think tanks like, you know, the Brookings Institution and other farther leftist organizations that really have been honing their vision for using public schools to recruit children into just straight up political activism. I mean, I've seen this in my own community. You know, there is a young lady, you know, who's going around basically asking people to donate their recycled items for her to make art out of it. And she's got the city's support behind her. She's 11 years old. Now, I have nothing against that technically, but when it's done to make a political point using public resources, we used to have an old consensus in this country that things that could be interpreted as being political shouldn't have public dollars behind it. Because what that does is basically puts the government seal of approval, puts its finger, you know, on one side or the other when really, you know, it should be up to the people to make up their own opinion without having to fight their own tax dollars in order to make it heard or take effect. So Action Civics, I mean, and add to this the fact that you and I have young children, you have had young children. Anyone who has any experience with a 10-year-old knows they need to be learning about their country. They're in a position of receiving the wisdom of their elders, of incorporating information passed down to them. They are not in a position of authority to be carrying out activism or leadership. Leadership is for those with wisdom and experience, neither of which a child has by definition.
How does Educating for American Democracy define democracy itself?
Well, you know, that's a really good question because the word democracy seems to be a weasel word right now, right? You know, people use it for everything, but I think it's because it's kind of like apple pie. It's assumed that no one opposes democracy, but that actually reveals a deep ignorance, again, about political theory, about philosophy, about political history, because the American founders actually crafted the United States very carefully to explicitly not be a democracy. So democracy basically means mob rule, and that has been well known by everybody who is a serious student of history, world history. So obviously there are democratic elements that are part of our system because our founders also believed in self-government, in requiring people to be accountable and responsible for their own decisions and to make as many of them as possible at the closest level of government possible to the issue at hand. So, you know, there are absolutely democratic elements to our governance, but to call us a democracy is just flat out false. And anyone who does that, you wonder if they misunderstand that fundamental idea of political theory, how can they really be assuming to try to lead the nation that they don't even understand?
What does Educating for American Democracy have in common with Common Core?
Well, I mean, in short, basically everything. The entire structure of how it is being rolled out and created is exactly the same template that Common Core used. Private nonprofit organizations to basically doing something that is a public interest job. But the thing that is wonky about having private nonprofit groups do it is the fact that, you know, private nonprofits are not subject to open records laws, to open meetings laws. They don't have to have transparency about who's funding what, who made what decision to make all of those records public. Hopefully, obviously, you know, government bodies such as school boards, curriculum committees, state boards of education, they all have to do that. So when you outsource that to private organizations, you actually ironically lose the transparency that is required for good, non-corrupt governance. And so that was the same way Common Core moved into place. It's also funded by taxpayers. So this project was helped, kind of fueled by $650,000 from the U.S. Department of Education to put out this report and try to kind of roll this out. And then as I'm watching the rollout happen, Todd, you know, I wrote a book about Common Core a couple of years ago, and that was, I know it's safe to say, you know, one of the reporters, few reporters in the country that followed it more closely than I did. So as I'm watching this happen with this Educating for American Democracy project for American history, it's just deja vu all over again. The same people, the same organizations, the same processes, exact same as Common Core. I fully expect that within his tenure, Joe Biden is going to announce that he supports the project and start forcing states and school districts into it. If that doesn't happen, I'll be extremely surprised.
And what would be his power to do that? The U.S. Department of Education?
Right. Well, I mean, you have pretty well-educated listeners. You know, it is unconstitutional for the federal government to affect education. That is under the 10th Amendment reserved to the state's powers exclusively. So, but obviously the federal government does have a role in education, and it gets around that constitutional prohibition basically by bribing states. So it takes your and my money, the money of everyone listening, launders it up to a bunch of bureaucrats at the federal level, and then launders it back down to most of the school districts in the nation. So the federal government now provides about 10 cents out of every dollar of public education spending that we get. So in exchange for that minority of funding to schools, it basically controls all of public education from the top down, which, again, is exactly what our founders did not want to happen and did not even think was a wise way to run education. Education is a very local, a very personal, very in-person, community-oriented activity. But now there's very little influence that parents truly have over the specifics of what happens in their local public schools. They get some window dressing stuff, sports jerseys and stuff, but more and more schools are basically outposts of bureaucrats at the federal level. So Joe Biden can, like Obama did with Common Core, threaten the states and say, oh, you want, your federal money for your schools? Well, just do everything that I say. And it's happened with Common Core. In the Common Core instance, all the states just bowed down, no matter whether they're run by Republicans or Democrats.
These ideas of educating for American democracy are being test run in Massachusetts. Tell us a little bit about that.
And again, this is another thing that's just like Common Core. So in Massachusetts, the state had been one of the leading, the number one state in the nation to make dramatic improvements in math, English, and social studies, which obviously encompasses history and government instruction. And they did it by extremely rigorous curriculum reform that was done over a number of period of years. It was created by a compromise between Republicans. And see, there is opportunities for possible compromise. At least there were 40 years ago. I'm not sure the opportunities for that are so available today. And that's partially because the left believes that they control all the levers of power. So why would they compromise when they don't have to? They can just get everything they want. And to some extent, that's true. But anyways, back 40 years ago, when more compromise was possible in Massachusetts, the Democrats got huge increase in funding for their public schools. And what the Republicans got out of it was the ability to control what the kids were learning to a greater extent. So that resulted in curriculum reforms, which the requirements for curriculum in Massachusetts were the best in the nation, and they were regarded as such all, across the country and the world. And they required specific content knowledge of children, things like, what does the First Amendment guarantee? How many items are there in the Bill of Rights? So we're not talking about what is your opinion of, global warming. That's a fuzzy personal opinion. We're talking objective knowledge passed down to children. That's how education should be run. Anyway, so Massachusetts implemented those reforms, and their kids skyrocketed on every test. They very clearly accelerated their kids' learning. And this was not just among rich kids. It's not just among, white and Asian kids. This was among minority children, Black, Hispanic, poor children also. Dramatic gains under this in Massachusetts. Well, the couple of years here, leftists took complete power in Massachusetts and began dismantling all of those historic reforms that benefited kids, including running their template of action civics in the state. So now they do. And so when I say the goal of that is to have children being activists in the streets, that is literally what has been done under the auspices of public education in Massachusetts in the past couple of years. They have middle school kids running around telling grown-ups what they should be doing. You know, and again, these kids, you know, they can't even feed themselves properly, right? Maybe they can't get themselves to school and they have opinions, you know, about big issues like poverty and climate change. You know, it's ridiculous. But that is, so basically Massachusetts has begun to lose all of its gains that children had made. It's really tragic. And they're substituting knowledge with political activism.
What would a real civics education look like?
You know, so I just alluded to that a minute ago, but really children, I mean, the purpose of schooling is not indoctrination. It's not socialization. It is not doing the things that are belong to families and churches. What a school does and should do uniquely is educate children. And what is education? Passing down knowledge. It is giving to children the core aspects of their cultural heritage, the achievements of their civilization, passing them on to children in a systematic, careful, you know, researched manner, and in a way that is proven, you know, step by step, that accelerates kids through the knowledge that they need to be contributing, functioning citizens and members of their families, and their communities. So a real civics education would fit within that framework by not manipulating children's feelings and emotions and lying to them about politics and oversimplifying very complex grown-up issues. You know, it would make sure that they understand just basic stuff that used to be the bread and butter, you know, of American of education 50, 60 years ago, 100 years ago. What are the three branches of government? What is their function designed to be? Why did America's founders do it this way? Use original source documents. The children should be familiar with the ideas, again, of their civilization, of their history, the influences, and the factual, major factual events that have shaped the world that they live in today. And so they need to be conversant with all of, you know, the big ideas that still affect the conversation that we have and our decision-making process as individuals and communities for how do we live a good life, how do we know what it is, and what have people thought about that in history. So there are many wonderful and excellent things that children need to be taught under civics education. I mean, they should memorize, frankly, you know, the Bill of Rights like my kids do in their classical school. They should be memorizing the preamble to the Constitution like my kids are doing in their classical school. They should be reading, you know, real philosophers in middle and high school, studying logic, argumentation, and debate so they know, you know, how to be honest contributors to discourse rather than using tricks and sleights of hand and, you know, rhetorical devices that are unfair. So all of those are things that are a legitimate civics education would pass on to children, and not one of them is found in this program, and that's by design.
Before we let you go, Joy, I did want your thoughts on the school openings or lack thereof and the resistance being met by parents and citizens who want the schools to open, especially in blue zip codes, the resistance being met there by the teachers' union. How do you understand that situation?
Well, it's kind of a crazy situation because I think parents are becoming aware of the fact that in a number of, I mean, for example, all across the country, private schools have been open almost this entire school year, and there has not been an increase in COVID cases or deaths from that fact. And that is the same internationally. And this isn't me just saying it. This is backed up by peer-reviewed research in the United States and abroad. It's just a fact. And then we also have seen evidence of it. I mean, statistically speaking, it is a undisputed fact that children, I believe we're talking 14 and under, according to CDC data, they are legitimately more at risk from the flu than from COVID. I, as a 30-something-year-old woman, am more or equally at risk to, you know, from falling downstairs than I am to die from COVID. So Americans are seeing that states like Florida have been open for months. There is no difference, and in fact, they have lower per population rates of, you know, COVID deaths and infections than other states that have had harder lockdowns. So a lot of the illusions and the lies that they have been fed are really dissipating under the light of reality. And then they're saying, look, my kids haven't been learning for a year. There's no difference between my child in California and a child in Florida, right? It's not like one of them's an alien and one of them's a human, you know? They're both human beings. The location and their governance is just different. And the kids are clearly not, you know, increasing risk to teachers. They're, you know, schools are just not found to be a major site of transmission for COVID. Kids don't seem to be super spreaders and all these scary things we were told. So parents are realizing that all the things we've been told about COVID for kids in schools is really false. And they've seen the negative things happening to their kids. For example, I could rant about this for a while, but very negative things happening to kids, not least of which that we know that, for example, and I wrote about this, you know, back last summer, a year ago, we know that just over the normal summers, pre-COVID summers, kids lost learning and that it affected them for the rest of their life. And so we know that losing an entire year of learning or having constant disruptions to their schooling, the kids who are affected by that, it will affect the rest. They will be losing career opportunities. They will be losing tens of thousands of dollars in promotions and earnings power for the rest of their life. And I do not think that money is the most important thing in life, but that, you know, is just one example that is easier to quantify and measure right now then. And then there's all these things such as child development, seeing grandma at Thanksgiving, you know, just developing basic social skills like kids need to do. They need to have constant interaction in order to grow into empathetic, caring adults, who can love people and serve people. They just need that, and they're not getting it. Anyway, so we're seeing all those negative things happen, and parents are starting to really face that kind of cognitive dissonance that really wasn't as painful a year ago. But at the same time, they're also seeing that in the face of all of this real concern for kids, that it's very clear that the best thing for kids is to be in school right now. Teachers' unions are basically holding millions of children hostage. They see this as an opportunity to basically get a bunch of more money out of scared people. And I mean, it's really that cynical. And they have whipped up many of their teachers' members into terror, the unfounded terror that if they go to school, they are going, you know, just going to be mass murder time, which again, not backed up by any evidence in the United States or abroad. So basically what's happening is this irrational belief, as well as the cynical opportunity to get a bunch of money out of Democrats who control Congress and the presidency and owe teachers unions big time, one of their major political supporters. That's what's really going into this whole entire situation. And it's clearly, you know, prolonging suffering for children. And again, this generation, the generation of kids growing up right now, they already were going to be handed the debt of all of their grandparents and parents for the entitlements that the United States has in place that we did not pay for pre-pandemic. We did not fund Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and showed no interest in doing so. And so those kids are going to be academically and economically crippled by COVID and school shutdowns. At the same time, they're going to be asked to carry the largest financial burden that ever has been handed to American kids in history.
Joy Pullman is managing editor of The Federalist. She is author of the book, The Education Invasion, and a recent column titled, If You Liked Common Core, You're Going to Love Joe Biden's Anti-American Civics Project. You can read it and purchase The Education Invasion on the Talk on Demand Archives page at issuesetc.org. Joy, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, you won't find this new civics project being taught at Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas. Faith Lutheran School equips students to stand firm in the faith through solid education focused on wisdom and virtue. They offer in-person instruction as well as live online classes for remote learning. Learn more by visiting flsplano.org, flsplano.org, Faith Lutheran School, Plano, Texas. Dr. John Bombaro joins us on the other side of the break. We're going to talk about scientism and superstition.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, three shows to wrap up St. Matthew: Resurrection, The Real Fraud, and Great Commission. Then on to Hosea with Introduction and the Children with Their Names. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand. Listen at thewordendures.org or your favorite podcast provider.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
Is your school or homeschool ready to take the next step in teaching students with learning challenges? We can help. The Simply Classical curriculum, voted number one for special learners, is available from Memoria Press for students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome. We provide everything you need for a full year. Use promo code LPR21 at simplyclassical.com. Simplyclassical.com.
Lutheranism in the public square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
When Martin Luther preached the dedication for the Torgau Church, he asserted that nothing else happened in this house but that our dear Lord speak to us and we respond in prayer, thanksgiving, and praise.
Issues Etc. guest Dr. John Pless.
The same could be said of Concordia Theological Seminary. This is a place where our Lord speaks to us through His Word, and we respond in joyful and thankful confession. We therefore invite you to visit our campus, where the Word of Christ dwells among us richly.
Learn more about studying for the vocations of pastor or deaconess at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Forming servants in Jesus Christ to teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, ctsfw.edu or 1-800-481-2155.